All right, we are now on paper 20. IAS 1.
Hi, everybody. Well, this agenda paper discusses a request that we received from ESMA where the submitter raises some concerns about the flexibility provided in IAS 1 on the presentation of expenses by function, on the presentation of additional lines, headings, subtotals, the presentation of additional statements or columns, and also they raise some concerns on the aggregation and materiality requirements in IAS 1. The submitter refers that the inherent flexibility in IAS 1 may impair the comparability and understandability of the financial statements. So in this paper, we provide a brief analysis of each one of the issues raised by the submitter. And you have observed that in the paper, we have suggested that some of these issues could, and please pay attention to the word could, be addressed by the disclosure initiative. But they are merely suggestions and nothing has been formalized yet of what they could address or not. At the moment, also, it's important to mention that there is an undergoing project on narrow scope amendments to IAS 1, IAS 7, and IAS 8. And that project will be taken to the ISB later this year. I think it's April this year. So maybe there will be another opportunity to address some of these concerns, but no promises yet. So having said that, I think, and I suggest to you that the focus of our analysis, of our discussion today, should be first on whether you agree with the staff recommendation that we should issue an agenda rejection. And the reason is because these issues raised on IAS 1 are too broad to be addressed by the Interpretations Committee. And also, because we have noted that some of these issues have already been or are being dealt with by the disclosure initiative. So, do you agree that we could proceed in those terms?
Before I ask for comments from the committee, I think because this was an issue raised by regulators, it would be nice to ask a regulator if she has an additional perspective to bring to this.
First, I would like to reiterate that it's a major concern for ESMAD, but also for IOSCO, and we often have discussion on IAS 1 on this presentation. Our comments is that we do agree that most of this issue should be dealt with by the disclosure initiative. We have quite a lot of concern regarding the way now the rejection is drafted, because we have the term flexibility, I think, twice, and judgment once, so we will prefer something more maybe factual on this one. And regarding issue C, which is it possible to add additional column in the P&L or additional statements in the primary statements? On this one, when we read the staff analysis, we think it's quite clear it's not allowed. So we would suggest to have a rejection saying it's not allowed by IAS 1.
Okay. Joanna?
Well, let's start with the positive and the conclusion. I agree that we shouldn't take it on and we should reject it. Not for the reasons given, and I have some significant concerns about some of the words in the paper. I think that we've said the reason, and you said the reason that we shouldn't take it on is because it's too broad, as opposed to the standard is clear what is required, and therefore we shouldn't address it, because I do not think it should be taken on full stop, which is why I'm saying that's why I disagree with taking it on. Yes, it's broad, but it is fundamentally changing what IAS 1 requires. And so, to me, that shouldn't be a reason that we shouldn't take it on. Because to me, IAS 1, and it is going to come back to Joanna's principles-based, is principles-based, and flexibility is a good thing as far as I'm concerned, and judgment is a good thing as far as I'm concerned. And we should not be advocating in any way, shape, or form a standard set of financial statements with only these headings. So that's where I guess I disagree with some of the things that are in your paper. But another
May I just interrupt you? I think that the agenda this rejection refers to those aspects. We cannot really question the principles in IS1.
Yeah, but the rejection also says that we note that it's far too big for us to deal with. Well, that's irrelevant as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think we're mentioning those three aspects. That there is also sufficient guidance in IS1.
Yep. But I would remove, I mean, if we go there, the first sentence of the one, two, whatever it is, the middle, the big paragraph just before the end. So the interpretation noted that to consider changing the underlying principles would be an issue that is too broad.
Yeah.
I would remove that. I mean, it's factually correct, but it's nothing to do with us. We're not looking at making changing principles. So why are we going to say that?
Well, I think the question we've been asked to.
Well, we don't change principles.
Yeah.
Because, okay, fine. I take your point. Yeah. Andrew?
The other thing, sorry, I haven't... The other thing that I have a real problem with is, sorry, and I'm now trying to find it. Question 4, paragraph 56, page 18. Does the Interpretations Committee agree that IS1 prohibits the presentation of additional information that is not required in IFRS as part of a complete set of financial statements? I fundamentally disagree with that. I do not see anywhere that precludes any other information being included in a set of primary financial statements. So, I can't articulate it any stronger than that. I cannot see anything in any standard that precludes you basically including what you like in a set of primary financial statements. And I would be horrified if we were effectively advocating that to the world.
With the caveat, of course, that you can't include anything that is in and of itself misleading.
Oh, of course, yeah. Of course. Okay. Yes.
Andrew?
Yeah, I agree with the overall direction the staff's heading. Certainly, we shouldn't take this onto our agenda at a time when discussions are taking place about the role of the business model in financial reporting, for example. It's not the time to start changing the balance between prescription and flexibility in IS1. I do have some concerns with the wording of the agenda decision, though. As Maria's indicated, it really does rather give the impression it's a complete free-for-all, and I think we should get some language in there. For example, in 70, paragraph 17b of IS1 talks about information being relevant, reliable, comparable and understandable. It's not the basis on which the judgment should be made. It should be brought out more fully rather than giving this impression that's kind of heaven knows anything goes.
Point taken. Martin?
Yeah, I guess of all the topic is too broad to put it on the agenda, and specifically on because of the ongoing discussion with regard to the relevant disclosure initiative. However, probably it would be worthwhile to select some issues in a kind of, say, piecemeal approach. For example, the question of, well, presentation of amortization and impairment expenses on capitalized development costs. Do we have a clear view on this or not? Another example would be the question where to allocate the equity result. Is there a difference when I have equity or joint venture? Is it in one line or two lines? I guess probably these might be some questions we could pick out of the overall agenda request and try to answer irrespectively of the ongoing disclosure project, because I believe they are fundamental and not just disclosure related.
Okay, let's hold that in for the rest of the comments. Florence?
I agree, so we should not do anything at this stage. I'm waiting to see what's coming up from the disclosure project. So I'm not sharing your view here, Martin. But I had exactly the same reaction as Joanna relating to issue C. If an issuer thinks that additional information should be provided, it should provide it as long and present it as long as this information does not contradict what another standard requires you to do.
Yeah.
Scott?
Perhaps it's the ex-regulator in me, but I looked a little kinder upon ESMA's concerns than I think some have. I didn't interpret ESMA's letter, once I read it, as opposed to just the staff paper, as saying eliminate flexibility. I read the letter as saying there are some who have interpreted the flexibility as meaning it's a free-for-all. Here are some examples. We would like the committee's help in stopping the free-for-all and restricting the flexibility to legitimate good faith judgments. So, for example, the first issue presented regarding by nature, by function presentations, if a company has chosen a functional presentation where it has costs of sales, is it appropriate for the company to take unusual large items like impairments out of cost of sales and put them elsewhere? I would have thought the answer is no, because if you're choosing a functional presentation and an item is part of cost of sales, for example, inventory impairments, right? You discover that a particular product line, which you have a lot of inventory for, is no longer selling because a competitor's product is better and cheaper, and so you write it all off. Gee, wouldn't it be nice to not have that be part of cost of sales? But I would have thought you can't do that. And I think that's the kind of thing that they're asking about in that issue. In the issue C, where I think the question asked by the staff is the wrong question, you know, does the committee agree you're not allowed to present additional information? No, I don't agree with that. You're allowed to present additional information. But I think the question asked was, can you put a pro forma income statement on the face?
Yeah.
Okay. I would have thought the answer to that is no. Right? You want to present some additional information beyond what's required, you got lots of places in the footnotes to do it. It don't go on the income statement. I mean, I thought that the paper didn't accurately describe what Esmond's real concerns are. And if there's a way we can help ESMA and other regulators deal with what I think their real concerns were from the letter, I'd be happy to do that. I do think a lot of it is, you know, hey, if you think people are being abusive, just tell them no. I mean, you know, some of it is just kind of the enforcement mechanism, and I don't know if there needs to be changes to the standards or interpretations to clarify that it's not a free-for-all. You know, I would have thought that's kind of already implicit in the standards. But, you know, I think some of the issues that are highlighted in the paper are issues of not exercise of judgment with flexibility within principles, but exercise of judgment and pointing at the literature to say, I can do whatever I want. And if we can help clarify that you can't do whatever you want, there are principles, and your exercise of judgment cannot defy them, then that might be helpful.
Tony?
I agree with the staff that it should come onto the agenda. But I share some of the thoughts that other people have had. My sense is that there is enough in IAS1 that establishes the principles to decide what is acceptable in the context of additional information, be it in the footnotes or on the face of the statements, and enough information to decide what, enough in the standard to determine what is actually misleading and wouldn't be allowed. For example, a pro forma income statement using a different basis of preparation on the face of the income statement. I think there is sufficient in IAS1 for management to make an appropriate judgment and for regulators to take appropriate action if they feel that the accounting is abusive. And so for example, I don't necessarily object to the idea of there being a separate line item for particular material transactions on the face of the income statement, if that is helpful. I don't necessarily object to the notion of an additional column. I do object to a pro forma on a completely different basis of preparation, but I think all of that is in the principles that we have. And so I might just take what I think Joanna and Andrew and Scott have said, is whether we can do something with the agenda decision, because I do think it seems to suggest that there's flexibility in judgment almost without limit, and refer back to the need for balance and neutrality and it not being misleading to capture both notions. And then I agree, we're not taking it on because it's too broad. It is, but we're not taking it on because the principles are in IAS1 and it's up to people to apply them appropriately. So maybe it's tweaking that last sentence of the third paragraph and the first sentence that Joanna referred to get some balance in.
Kaz and then John.
Yes, I agree with what everybody else said, that just to leave it for disclosure initiatives. But one thing I just want to add is question 3, which is C. I disagree with your staff view, and particularly that is not consistent with the IAS 21 currently explicitly allow financial statement with a currency other than functional currency. That is additional information.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't say that's to prohibit additional information, which is to cause some other issues.
Okay, Gary, board member privilege.
Actually agree with the conclusion. Some of this will just be repetitive, but I think it's important reinforced. I think the disclosure initiative can handle much of this thing, but I think, although the rejection letter is sort of long, but it's sort of blandly factual, I think we could use it to reinforce, as Tony was suggesting, certain points and noting in rejecting the notice the committee, you know, noted the objectives IS1 is, you know, flexibility and judgment such as, you know, or we believe it does not permit for pro forma columns or totals or what. I think we can use it to make statements that would be useful, you know, to the regulators and pretty much everybody else that might be wanting to have some, you know, liberties, shall we say, you know.
Point taken. I think that's a common theme I hear coming through here. John? And then Don?
Yeah, I mean, similar to others. I mean, I agree with not taking the issue on, but I do think there is an issue. I do think that the principles in IAS1 are read in many places by many people as a bit of a free-for-all. And I think it is, I think illustrations or guidance on the application of the principles in IAS1 would be more than useful. I mean, we, in my experience, we have issues with the presentation of information in the statements in almost all jurisdictions with regulators and preparers and auditors. So I do think there is an issue. And I think that the line between what's sort of abusive versus what's genuine flexibility to portray the most relevant sort of performance statement, I think is very blurry. And I think more guidance in IAS1 and maybe the disclosure initiative can look at that would actually help. Without changing it from being a principles-based to, I mean, I'm not in favor of a prescriptive format, but I think more guidance on the application of principles would be useful.
Okay, Don and then Alan.
Yeah, just following on from that, I mean, did I hear at the beginning also that there's going to be a project on IAS1 and IAS8? I don't know if that's what you were going to come in on, Alan. But I mean, I talking to ESMA staff before coming to the meeting, certainly they were disappointed by the not surprised by the rejection notice, but disappointed by the way in which it was worded. So I think the conversations around the table about trying to see where you could do more would be very welcome. They also had some concerns, though, about whether the disclosure project would be able to deal with all of these things, and thought that maybe there are some things that really need to be revisited in IAS 1. So that's why I was picking up on that point. And I just wanted to say also, in terms of the sort of consultation and outreach here, to me it seems that one of the fundamental problems that ESMA has when it's looking at this is that the presentation of the income statement is something that, in moving, transitioning to IFRS from national GAAPs, companies, a lot of them anyway, tried to keep as closely to what they'd been doing in the past as they could under IFRS. They didn't really want to make any changes to that sort of basic thing about the way they presented their results. And I think a lot of that has persisted, and so you know, a national standard setter might not really be able to see that and comment on it, because they're probably looking particularly at the way in which their companies in their jurisdiction are presenting and their performance. But ESMA's looking across, you know, 28 now different member states and the way in which they're applying IFRS, and they've all had to transition from different national GAAPs. And so they are actually seeing a lot of divergence in practice around this. And after all, that, you know, the income statement is something of fundamental importance. And so, you know, this issue of comparability here is a key one. So whatever you can do on this and picking up the project, I think, would be very important. Thank you.
Alan?
A few points. I'm sitting reading the ballot draft of the amendments to IS1. And one of the things that we address is whether you can present additional line items, for example, in the income statement, and putting some constraints around that. So it says that they must be made up of items measured and recognised in accordance in compliance with IFRS, presented and labelled in a manner that constitutes what the subtotal makes it understandable, calculated on a consistent basis from period to period, and not displayed with more prominence than the specific subtotals referred to in the standard. So we're getting the sense of some sort of constraints around what you can do for those other sides. It's still possible that I'll have a word to the team afterwards. It's still possible that we could emphasise in the basis for conclusions that it's important, and go back to the points I made about clarity and relevance and so on. But we're starting to address some of those issues here. There are some. I have no doubt that the disclosure initiative, or the POD as it's going to be called soon, I think Principles of Disclosure, will have a look at a very wide range of issues, including things like nature by function and so on. A lot of the issues in the ESMA letter, some of them get a bit tricky because they sort of morph into standards in terms of, is this part of the measurement of cost of goods sold, for example? But there are some fundamental things that we've never addressed, like definition of operating profit. I think what we're, the implication of the amendments we are about to ballot would be that somebody probably could call it an operating profit. We're not going to put that in there as an example, but they could have an operating profit line as long as it is a subtotal within there, and it's clear what's in there, and it's consistent from period to period, and until we come along and define what operating profit might be in the future. So I think we're going to get some constraints around that. One of the hardest thing though is this comparability issue, because one of the other amendments in here is about the structure of the notes. That's a debate we've had at the table with the board. At the moment it talks about the normal order of presentation is, and it's accounting policies and so on, and then the order of the notes as presented in financial statements. And there's a fundamental difference about whether that it's good or a bad thing. Some people argue that means that you can look at a set of financial statements and they're sort of comparable, but it means that a bank where a property, plant, and equipment is not that important, it might be the first note the same as the manufacturing or vice versa. There's no, and I don't call it flexibility, but in order to present the most relevant and meaningful information, perhaps it's better to put the important information first. And so we're trying to get to the heart of that. Now, some people say that that means it's not comparable because they're not identical, that you're not filling in the boxes in the same order. On the other hand, we'd actually argue that it's more comparable because you've got two companies saying what the most important things are to them, so it is comparable. That's a fundamental debate that we have to have. It's part of the scoping document for the Principles of Disclosure project, which goes to the ASAF, our Accounting Standards Advisory Forum, in March, and to our board in March as well. So you're going to start to see the full scoping of this project in March, and includes looking at ISS 1, 7 and 8. It wasn't in our discussion forum feedback statement, but IFRS 5 kind of fits in there as well, because if you're going to start to look at the income statement and how it's structured, I can't see how you can close your eyes to discontinued operations. So, so I think you'll see that it's quite a comprehensive approach.
Marie, last word, and then I'm going to try and figure out how to wrap this.
Yeah, I do agree in our letter that there are some different elements, some which are really wide. For example, on the operating profit, an additional line, and I do agree that's something huge and should be dealt with the disclosure subcommittee. Regarding, but some other, I do fully agree with what Scott said. I think it's where exactly you stop saying it's a matter of judgment and is there some elements, and that's exactly the question with the difference between the P&L by function and by nature. Can you mix both? Or the idea of an additional column, is it possible to have on the face of your P&L a column which is pro forma? Is that allowed? On this one, if for you IAS 1 is clear, I mean, it will really help to have something in the ridicule notes.
Let me, I sense a broad agreement that this should not go on our agenda. Broad recognition that the board has projects underway that will deal with a lot of the issues. Also, a broad sense that the agenda rejection or the agenda notice, excuse me, and then I'll go to the phones to see before I lose my train of thought, should have some wording in it that is a bit of an exhortation. And I think Andrew suggested some wording that we can take straight out of one that says, I forget the precise language, but you had paragraph reference in mind there that we can add. So that's my sense. Now, the alternative is the point that Martin made, that is a much more granular approach, looking at some specific kinds of problems. My sense is that the points that Martin raised are not the same dimension as the, put it charitably, you've got to be kidding if you think one allows that, the pro forma income statement on the face. Who are we kidding? Somebody thought they could get away with it, but I wouldn't have thought you could ever get close, and I think we need to make our exhortations need not refer to that specific case, but we have to make it clearer that it's not unlimited flexibility. Scott, and then I do need to go to the phones. I've been discourteous there.
Just, you know, to add to the, you know, how could you possibly think you could do that? I have recently reviewed a set of draft IFRS financial statements where in the middle of the income statement, there was an operating profit line, and then there was a box underneath it that said, consists of recurring exceptional. So they broke down operating profit. I asked, well, what is exceptional? And they said, well, that's extraordinary items, but we're not allowed to present extraordinary items. So they're exceptional. And inside this box is a breakdown of operating profit that doesn't flow in the financials. It's a subtotal that breaks down the subtotal above it. I told them I thought it was entirely clear that that was not permitted. You can do that stuff in the notes if you want to provide some analysis. If you think these exceptional items, whatever they are, merit their own line item in the flow of the income statement, you can do that. But, you know, this is not permitted. They said, oh, no, we've done it this way for 10 years. Our auditors say it's okay. Our regulator says it's okay. I won't say what country they're from.
Some of us would have to say
I was shocked, you know, to think that somebody thought that was all right. But it wasn't just somebody. It was lots of somebodies thought it was all right. So, I mean, I think this is a real issue that Esma's raised, and I'd love to be able to do something to rein it in a little bit, you know, instead of this much flexibility, only this much flexibility, so that people understand that there are bounds.
Okay, let me go to the phones here. I've been rude. Sandy?
I don't want to revisit
things that have been said. I guess I agree with a lot of what Scott said, both first and just now, that, you know, to me, ESMA's raising real issues about flexibility versus abuse. And it seems to me they're saying that the wording isn't sufficiently clear that they can actually say on these abusive things that, hey, that's not allowed. And so it seems like on the first two items that they are asking us to do something, and certainly the third, you know, with additional columns. I mean, I guess I'm less hopeful on the disclosure initiative that will actually address things, and I sort of feel differently at the use of the nomenclature disclosure initiative versus presentation, because we make a very clear distinction in our minds about presentation versus disclosure, and they're not the same, and that we have certain principles about presentation, of which some of these first three items relate, that are very important to us, you know, by nature is very important to us versus by function. You know, it seems like these line items, we have no problem with splitting line items, but adding subtotals and identifying things that are non-recurring that happen all the time, you know, those are abusive things to us. You know, I think ESMA's done a good job of identifying things that are intentionally meant to guide users in a direction that maybe they shouldn't be guided, and that we should pay attention to what they've said. And I feel like the agenda rejection, particularly the penultimate paragraph, is a bit too dismissive of their concerns and says, oh, yeah, we're taking care of that. It's clear we're taking care of it in the disclosure initiative. And I felt like it was a little too dismissive of the points that they actually raised. And, you know, I guess in the paper that no one's talked a lot about the materiality concerns, I guess I would just raise that, you know, I feel like the comments on materiality here were more based upon what a preparer's view of the materiality issues are than what users' views of materiality. I don't think that they believe that there's this massive overload of information and they just can't take any more. That's not what we hear at all. I feel very strongly in that, you know, we need to, every time I have the opportunity to say that's not what we hear, I feel the need to say that, because I feel like that's being used right now to push to take things out of financial statements that are important. So I guess I feel like the agenda rejection should be changed a little bit. And, you know, I forget who said at the very beginning, I think it was someone from ESMA who said, at least, you know, can you do something about additional columns? You know, I viewed that one differently. And to me, it seems like we could have a slightly different word. But those are my thoughts.
Thank you. Luca?
I share the view of the majority that this is something that we cannot manage as IFRIC, and so it's appropriate not to include an agenda. I would like to add some other comments, because I share in any case not all but the majority of the concern of ESMA. What I'm seeing nowadays is that there is a risk that the flexibility expressed by EIS-1 could be overcome when we will be forced to apply the XBRL model, because from what I have seen, there are some problems in applying the label, specific and personal and customized label, to a system that is very rigid. So my worry is that I would like to avoid that from one part we will maintain a certain level of flexibility that I agree has to be in some way regulated or that can be reasonable. And on the other part, we have to face the problem to have systems or the way in which we have to present information that are more rigid and that are not able to capture the flexibility required or permitted by the standards. At the same time, what I have seen during these years is that also national regulators sometimes requires you to not only add additional information to take in consideration something that is not captured by the way in which EIS-1 is now written. For instance, we have something similar to the Scott example in Italy. We are obliged by council to present in our disclosure the non-recurring items. That sounds quite similar to something that is special items or that is an extraordinary items. And this is an additional information that is not labeled as a special event, but at least some additional information that the regulator thinks that is important, or worse, that's to present additional columns, for instance, in Italy, to present the related party transaction, not only in the disclosure, but also in the formats. So what I'm seeing is a lot of confusion regarding these facts. My previous background was to work with the very rigid formats, so for me it will not be a problem to have a rigid format to work on and put the flexibility of the information in the disclosure. I agree with Sandy that is a clear distinction between presentation and disclosure. At the same time, what I really worried is that if we will maintain a view to have a EIS-1 with a certain level of flexibility, this could be undermined and reduced dramatically from the adoption, obliged adoption, compulsory adoption of a language like XBRL that it seems at the moment that does not provide the same level of flexibility that is required by EIS-1. So I see a big level of, the risk of a big level of inconsistency. So there is an issue, absolutely. I think that is not an issue that should be managed or could be managed by AFRIC, but at the same time, I think that we should underline this point to the board in order to try to let them make thoughts regarding these items.
Let me take Luca's point. XBRL is certainly beyond my competence. I think, though...
Also mine.
I'm thinking about maybe the level of detail that we could do, and let me use the example of an extra column. If we all said, well, if you put a pro forma column in, that's, you can't do that. In Brazil, you are required by law to present the consolidated and the parent-only financial statements side by side. I don't think that's at all misleading, at all in contravention of IAS-1. I don't have any problem with that at all, because they're not pro forma. They're presentations of the same thing. And my concern is that if we go beyond a general exhortation, we're going to find ourselves trapped in the well, what if business. So my proposal would be that we add that language. I'm going to ask Andrew to work with Denise to get that right, since he articulated it. The other comment that was made was that sufficient guidance already exists in IAS-1. Well, if it, or is in the disclosure initiative, Well, if that statement is true, then the ballot draft that Alan is reading is unneeded. So probably want to alter that language as well. With those changes in mind, do I see support? Okay, that's what we'll do. Was that clear enough, Denise?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Denise frequently interrupts me and says, I haven't got any idea what you're talking about, so we have to make sure.
Two things that Sandy raised.
Very yes, quickly
respond. So Sandy raised two issues. One is the importance of a distinction between presentation and disclosure. If we read IS-1, it is interchangeable. Sometimes we think presentation is about the primary financial statement. Sometimes it's about the notes, because it says you can present in the on the face or in the notes, and sometimes disclose on the face or in the notes. So we're trying to get some more consistency in the language. But the proposed scope of the project says presentation principles for the primary financial statements and disclosure principles for the notes. So we are trying to address this holistically. It's not just about taking disclosures. The FASB's done, I think, in focusing on the note disclosures. In terms of materiality, we have a separate thread for that. We have a joint project with IOSCO and the IAASB, because we believe that materiality is driven by different ways people think about it. So we're working with both the auditors and the regulators. Our next meeting, fortunately I can say, is 12:30 tomorrow. We have a joint phone call to discuss the scope of that particular project as well. So we're assessing whether we should provide or develop more application guidance or education material, whether we need to make changes, or whether just writing an interesting research paper might help people understand the different perspectives that people have on materiality. So there's some work going on in that area as well. And the last one, just for Luca, because I can't let it go unsaid. With XBRL, we're doing so much work on that, and one of the things we're trying to educate people on is the difference between the label link base, as we call it. In other words, the label you use to describe something and the underlying tag that you use, so that there is, you can, if you know for auditing purposes what cash is, and the auditors have to sign off, that's the element. You might want to call it something else in your label, but that's the description that you put on that, but you know it's linked into there. So if the standards give you flexibility, then capturing it on the IFRS taxonomy should give you the same flexibility, because our objective is for the taxonomy and the data capture process to mimic the financial reporting, but then give the consumer the flexibility to read it in a different ways. It's not about introducing a rigidity with the XBRL that doesn't exist in the standards.
Fair comment.
Okay.
Look, before we leave this, Marie, is that supportive to your need, to the best we can? Okay. Denise, next paper, which is paper
21. So this agenda paper discusses a request to clarify the application of the requirements regarding the presentation and content of the condensed statement of cash flows in the interim financial statements. And more specifically, it addresses some concerns raised on the application of paragraph 10 of IAS 34, which refers mainly to the content. The submitter states that there are two views on the application of these requirements, and one view is that an entity could present a detailed structure of the condensed statement of cash flows, and another view is that an entity could present a three-line condensed statement of cash flows showing only totals for operating, investing, and financing cash flow activities. So we analyze these views. We acknowledge that paragraph 10 may provide a technical basis for presenting a three-line condensed statement of cash flows, and we believe that is not acceptable. The condensed statement of cash flows should be more detailed. And for this reason, we are proposing an amendment that could be part of the annual improvements project, and that would emphasize two main things: that a condensed financial statement should include information reflecting the changes in financial position and performance of the entity since the latest annual reporting period, and that an entity should present additional line items to prevent information in a financial report from being misleading. So, do you agree with the amendment?
Scott?
This is a bit difficult for me to think about. I have not seen a situation where I believe that only presenting the subtotals is sufficient. Every time I've seen that, I've said, nah, you know, I think you got to have more to prevent the financial statements from being misleading. But the changes that we're proposing to paragraph 10, the staff's proposing to paragraph 10, essentially say there is never a situation in which only presenting the headings and subtotals is not misleading. You must always find some other line items. That seems to me to be a more significant change than we usually do in an annual improvement. You know, as it's written now, mm-hmm. it says start with the headings and subtotals and do more if you need to. We're proposing to change it to say start with the headings and subtotals and then figure out what else you need to add, but you will definitely need to add something. I like the change because it reflects my experience that I've never believed that only the subtotals was enough, but I wouldn't have thought this was an annual improvement.
Andrew?
I just don't think this change is necessary. If a change was necessary, I wouldn't make this change. The outreach, Scott's observations, my observations indicate there's very little diversity in practice. I think the average said 96% of entities are reporting on a more detailed basis, but IAS 34...
I'd say 99%.
I didn't look at the other 3%, yeah, Scott, but very little diversity in practice. But you know, IAS 34 does start with the bare minimum is the headings and line items in the headings and subtotals in the annual financial statements, and the test to add more is whether or not that is misleading, and that requires some judgment. In the great, great majority of cases, entities are applying that judgment with the outcome that they're adding more line items. If we wanted to kind of turn it around and really, I just find, frankly, this wording is kind of saying the same thing in a different way, or it's too nuanced to clearly have the impact which I think the staff desires it to have, I'd start with saying include the headings, subtotals, and line items as per the annual financial statements and only amalgamate things if that is not misleading, put the onus on the preparer. But I don't recommend that change. I just think that would be a clearer way of going about where I think you want to get to, but I just don't think we have a problem in practice that justifies this change.
Joanna?
I guess I'm on the same page as Scott and Andrew, but I think really importantly that if it is not misleading to just do the three line items, then I don't see that is a problem. The principles are you give the information that is required for it not to be misleading. And if you think you've got very little cash flows and you think that it's not misleading, then just to do those headings, then you could. I agree that 99% or 97% or whatever percent you want, people don't do that because they are applying, and IAS 34 is very, very clear that you've got to give additional information. So I just think that this is unnecessary to actually require anything further. And as Scott says, the change actually being proposed basically says thou must add something else.
Denise?
Honestly, at first when I was writing this paper, I thought about issuing a tentative agenda decision and to say it's clear, it's not misinterpreted. However, when I received this result from the outreach request and some unsolicited comments that I also mentioned in the paper, many people agreed that even though there was a prevalent approach in practice, there could be some room for confusion and misunderstanding in paragraph 10.
Room for confusion or room for abuse?
Well, you are right. Room for abuse.
But room for abuse means you're not complying with the standard. And our job is not to create some rules to make people comply.